When Merle Evans was a little girl, her grandmother was in the habit of supervising Merle's evening prayers. "Get back here, baby girl," Grandma would call if her little charge jumped up too soon. "You forgot to ask God to make you a blessing." Merle grew up with this refrain in her ears to such an extent that it became well lodged in her heart and in her mind. As a teenager, Merle began college in Lorman, Mississippi. "Stay away from the servicemen," Grandma cautioned. Apparently, that advice, late on the scene, did not stick so well. At the very first football game of the season, in her very first year of college, Merle met fellow student and Army veteran Medgar Evers. A year later, the two were married. And before long, they were immersed in civil rights work, which took them all over the state and placed extra burdens on Merle in caring for the three children, as Medgar was so often away from home. Merle and Medgar had 12 years together before he was killed one night in his own driveway, shot in the back, in the dark, by someone who opposed equal rights and open opportunity for all. If ever there was a moment to test a person's faith in the idea that God gives us life so that we can be a blessing to others, that must have been it for Merle. How does one overcome such loss and such hatred? Merle was aware that she was awash in bitterness and anger. She wanted to fight. So what she did was move to Southern California and return to college. She wanted to finish that bachelor's degree that she had started. As a 32-year-old mother with three kids at home, not to mention, as she put it, a black person in the land of whites, she felt out of place on campus. But she persisted and she graduated in 1968. In the 45 years since then, Merle has been an activist, a leader, a writer, a speaker, a strong supporter of family and friends, a person willing and able to pray in public. You might remember her on the platform at our president's most recent inauguration, and even a performing artist in Carnegie Hall. She has, in fact, been a blessing to a multitude of others. Merle Evers Williams is 80 years old now. "People choose, I think, what they want to be," she says. "People choose what they want to be." As she looks back on it now, that's her view of her life. The conviction that we're meant to be a blessing to others is not original to Merle's grandmother. In fact, it's deeply ingrained in our religious tradition, which goes back centuries to the time when the Hebrew people first began to sense that God had a special purpose for them. "I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing," goes that ancient promise spoken by God and recorded in Genesis chapter 12. "In you, all the families on the earth shall be blessed." And so that we do not forget our purpose, the prophets, like stern but deeply loving grandmothers, have been there to remind us. "I will save you, and you shall be a blessing," God insists through Zechariah, to take one example. "Do not be afraid, let your hands be strong." Those who knew and followed Jesus must have felt as close as they'd ever been in their lives to the fulfillment of that long and deeply held dream of being a blessing to others. Jesus healed everyone who came to him. He fed everyone who was hungry. He spoke of good news for the poor, release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, and liberation for the oppressed. He seemed to actualize these things wherever he went. And those who traveled with him were part of it. They shared in the healing. They shared in the feeding. They shared in the teaching. They saw how people were being blessed. personally, they were filled with joy and hope for the even wider blessings that Jesus was bringing as the kingdom of God was coming ever nearer. Jesus was making it all seem more vividly possible and alive and visible than it had ever been before. And then he was killed, betrayed at night, arrested at night, charged and purportedly tried the same night, and crucified the next day by people who opposed everything that he was trying to do. Those who loved Jesus must have felt betrayed as well. Jesus and they right along with him were striving above all to be a blessing to others. Now he was dead. What kind of reward or fulfillment of promise was that? Shocked and afraid though they might have been, a handful of the disciples managed to claim the body and see it placed in a stone burial cave. Following the established habits of a lifetime, they then observed the requirement of the Sabbath day of rest. And following that, the women of the group set out to give Jesus' body a proper preparation for burial. They intended to wash his body, to apply the traditional oils, and to rewrap it with the necessary spices. Let's remind ourselves again of what happened next. On the first day of the week, at early dawn, this is Luke chapter 24, the women came to the tomb, taking the spices that they had prepared. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they went in, they did not find the body. While they were perplexed about this, suddenly two men in dazzling clothes stood beside them. The women were terrified and bowed their faces to the ground. The men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He's not here. He has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be handed over to sinners and be crucified and on the third day rise again?" Then they did remember his words, and returning from the tomb, they told all this to the 11 and to the rest. Now it was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the other women who were with them that told this to the apostles. But the words seemed to the others to be an idle tale, and they did not believe them. Peter got up and ran to the tomb. Stooping and looking in, he saw the linen cloths by themselves. Then he went home, amazed at what had happened. The first thing that we might notice in this account of the initial resurrection discovery is that what the women had prepared themselves for was not what they found. Cheryl Stray's realization, based on her experience of walking along in very difficult trail, seems pertinent here. "I believed that all the things I'd been before had prepared me for this journey," she writes, "but nothing had. Nothing could. Sometimes even the day before didn't prepare me for what would happen next." The group of women disciples were prepared to properly care for the no longer living body of someone they loved. What they found, however, was an empty tomb. What they encountered was not death, but a strange absence. And then two beings of dazzling light. It was enough to make them bend over in fear and shock. The question and the explanation that was put to them made them start to look back on the recent past. But now they had a new perspective. They were looking as if with newly opened eyes and newly opened ears. "Risen," they went back murmuring. "He's risen?" The women went looking for the other disciples to tell them the story and so that they could talk together and try to make sense of it. And the next thing we notice in this story is that whatever new or unexpected thing is happening, nobody really absorbs it or fully comprehends it in an instant. When the women first tell what they've seen to others who had shared life with Jesus for 3 years, most of those others concluded that the women were delirious with fatigue and grief and that their story simply was not credible. According to Luke, only Peter went to check out the report for himself. And what he felt when he got there was not full understanding, but amazement. amazement. It seems that when a new day dawns and a new reality begins to unfold, we cannot necessarily expect that all of the implications are going to become clear at once. We have to live into it. We have to go with it. Stay open and see what happens as it begins to solidify within us and around us. The empty tomb was discovered at sunrise, but that was by no means the only significant event of the day. Luke goes on to tell how two disciples on that same day were walking from Jerusalem to Emmaus, and they met a stranger. At least they thought it was a stranger, who walked with them and asked them questions and talked to them about the scriptures. They were so enthralled with his words that when they arrived at their destination in Emmaus in the late afternoon, they insisted that he come in and stay with them. It was only when he took bread and blessed it and broke it that they recognized it was Jesus who had been walking and talking with them. And in the very moment of recognition, Jesus vanished from their sight, and the two disciples were left saying to each other, "Were our hearts not burning within us while we were walking along the road and he was opening the scriptures to us?" It was in hindsight that they began to think, well, maybe they'd sort of known at some level, but it had taken them hours and a certain familiar gesture of blessing and breaking and sharing before they fully caught on. Well, at this point, who cares if evening was coming on? The two were so excited that they jumped up and hurried all the way back to Jerusalem, where they found another group of disciples convened and excitedly talking about how Simon had seen Jesus. The two just back from Emmaus told their story, and then suddenly Jesus was standing among them again, saying, "Peace be with you." It's late on the day of the resurrection now, you understand, but the disciples are still feeling really disoriented and confused, and truth be told, in this moment, they become terrified all over again. How could they not be? Jesus had been nailed to a cross. He had breathed his last. Now here he was, inviting them, "Touch me and see," inquiring, "Do you have anything to eat?" and trying to explain to them the meaning of what had happened and what they could anticipate about their future. "You will be my witnesses," is what he says to them. In other words, you will yet be a blessing to others. Newness of life is like this. It isn't made clear or fully realized all at once. It unfolds its truth over time. Usually involves both fear and joy, and includes both disbelief and wonder, as well as renewed purpose and praise. The first inkling of a new day is exactly that, just an inkling. We don't know in advance where this new expression of God's life is going to take us. We can only start the journey in fear and trembling, and then welcome whatever joy ultimately unfurls as we go along. Karen and Colin Archiplay's first inkling that they might have entered a new day was an astronomical water bill. They had recently purchased a 3-acre avocado farm in Valley Center, and they dreamed of living in the country and growing food organically. The first water bill they received and opened, hundreds of dollars beyond anything that they'd ever known in their lives up to this point, made them realize that they had a whole lot to learn in a really big hurry. You might say that they were shocked into alertness. Colin, who was a Marine deployed at that time in Iraq, began to spend all of his off-duty hours in a self-designed farming education program that he pieced together from the internet. By the time he returned home a few months later, he was ready to hit the ground running. He went right to work, and using a combination of new technology and time-tested traditions, he dramatically cut water usage and increased crop yield. But Karen and Colin's adventure was only just beginning. When Colin's company of soldiers prepared to redeploy a little bit more than a year later, he felt a really strong pull to want to go with them. But Karen suggested another way to honor the bonds of loyalty and of friendship that had developed, another way that they might serve the country. "How about we start helping returning veterans with their transition to civilian life," she suggested. In his characteristic, "I'll get right on it" fashion, Colin then wrote a curriculum and started recruiting students through the VA and local military bases, and soon launched Veterans Sustainable Agriculture Training, a six-week program that has graduated 160 men and women in the 4 or so years of its existence, 95% of whom are now employed. Life-changing is how former students describe it. Healing, practical, challenging, educational in the best sense of the word, offering new opportunities for leadership. These would be other accurate descriptions. Who could have predicted when Karen opened that first nausea-inducing water bill that all of this would be the result? And to hear the way writers and supporters and affiliates talk about Archie's Acres, what's happened so far is now starting to seem like it was only the beginning. Plans are in the works to replicate and expand the model so that it can be a blessing to even more people around the country. Kimberly Ritter's first inkling that something new was happening in her life was when she made the shocking discovery, at least it shocked her, that modern-day slavery is not something that only takes place in other countries, but it happens also right here in the United States in our own towns and cities. Kimberly's a meeting planner, and one of her clients happens to be the Federation of the Sisters of St. Joseph. Kimberly was planning a conference for the sisters, and they said to her, "Oh, be sure that the hotel that you find and choose to host our conference, be sure the hotel has signed on to the ECPAT standards." Kimberly had no idea what they were talking about. ECPAT. She started asking questions and doing research, and she was disturbed to learn that hotels just like those she had worked with have been, more often than we like to imagine, a venue for human trafficking crimes. She also learned in the course of her research that hotels can reduce or prevent such crimes by training their employees and training their suppliers and vendors how to recognize and report suspicious activities. That's what ECPAT, End Child Prostitution and Trafficking, is all about. Well, as someone who'd worked in the industry for 20 years, Kimberly decided not only was she horrified with what she had learned, she also realized that she was in a position to make a difference by working to convince decision makers that it would be better to be proactive and prevent crimes and save lives than it is to pretend a problem does not exist. And so she rejoiced 2 years ago when she and her clients convinced the Millennium Hotel in St. Louis to sign the standards in a special public ceremony. Then, the next day she woke up, having had that day of happiness, she woke up and realized, not enough. That was only a beginning. I need to do more and I want to do more. Subsequently, Kimberly has become a very effective advocate for victims and for prevention strategies. She's made it a focal point of her own business, and she's also joined the board of a nonprofit Human Action Network, where she serves as vice president. She's received the gratitude of many young people that actually her work has helped and rescued. She's received their gratitude for the work that she's doing. And what they say to her is, please keep doing this, and may you be blessed for blessing us. Kimberly intends to continue on. This has been life-changing for all of us, she says, including her colleagues and her co-workers in her statement. It's created a whole new world for us. The opening of a new world, the dawning of a new day, it seems, is often opened to us by loss. The loss of innocence or health, the loss of a job or a sense of identity, the loss of security, the loss of a loved one or a familiar home. It seems paradoxical, yet it is the Easter story. Jesus is killed, and the pain, the crushing disappointment, the confusion are very real. And then a new day dawns, and somehow the disciples are called or pulled or carried forward to meet it. The new reality takes time to emerge, but eventually their life and Jesus' life become so much more than they ever could have previously imagined. So it is by the grace of God that even in the darkest times, we're able to look forward and to know for certain that we still can and will be a blessing to others and to the world. Joy has not deserted us forever, but will return to us, first in glimmers, then in waves, and finally as a steadfast flame burning within us. Christ is risen, God of light and goodness and hope. Today we join all those who have loved and served you throughout the ages in being a little bit perplexed, yet also awestruck, puzzled, humbled, and yet also amazed by your power and your vision for life. Lord Jesus, we realize now that disbelief is part of the experience of following you. You take us to such surprising places. You meet us in such unexpected ways that incredulity cannot help but be our first reaction. We are so grateful, Lord, for the ways that you meet us and walk beside us, patiently explaining things to us, letting us experience the realness of your presence and your love. As the new day moves past the dawn, when we find your tomb empty, and grows warm in the light of the strong hope we have in you, may we become increasingly free and willing to embrace the good news of your resurrection and the new ways that we might live with you and for you in the world. We thank you for all those who have loved us and inspired us in important ways throughout our lives, including those remembered by these gifts of fragrant and beautiful lilies. Like flowers opening to fruitfulness and to joy, we turn toward your fullness of life and stretch our arms wide to receive and to give, praying as we do the prayer you taught us to pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory.